Hi, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is...
I'm William Robinson. I'm a professor of sociology at the University of California at Santa Barbara.
And it's a great privilege and honor to have you with us. So my first question is to ask, what is currently dynamizing, concerning, interesting, propelling, retarding you?
Yeah, well, both my research and my political and social concerns over the last few years have been what I consider to be an unprecedented crisis of global capitalism. Every single level, it's dragging humanity down. It's leading us towards war and endless conflict, ecological collapse, social disintegration and crisis. So this has been my central preoccupation, certainly since 2008.
And 2008 is when we understand the global financial crisis to have begun. I remember talking to a guy based in Santa Barbara who ran a magazine for the wealthy. And in the midst of the crisis, I was living in LA at the time, he was at a party there. I asked him, so what's happening in terms of your ad revenue? Is it down? No, not at all. What's happening in terms of the feature stories you're running? Nothing. We don't talk about it. So I asked him why. He said, our readers don't know there is a global financial crisis.
Right. Well, of course, Santa Barbara is one of the most exclusive communities in the United States and maybe worldwide. You can maybe buy a house in Los Angeles that would cost you $600,000, might be $10 million in the exclusive zones in Santa Barbara. So the clientele reading the magazine, is not surprising that they are living in a bubble. They're completely insulated from this crisis swirling around them. I don't think there'd be any doubt about that. But there's something else as well, and that corporate profits are at an all-time high. Financial profits are at an all-time high. So even in the midst of this incredible crisis, in the midst of a global financial collapse in 2008, it's not directly affecting yet the earnings of what I call the transnational capitalist class and the affluent sectors that are benefiting from current global arrangements. So it's kind of surprising that this person, you know, publishing a magazine is not aware of this crisis swirling around, you know, around us all around the planet. But it's not surprising that he and his readership was and still is not so concerned about it.
Well, Prof, he turned on his heel and walked away from me. And it was clear that I had mentioned something that should not have been spoken of. Right?
Yeah.
And when you refer to a transnational capitalist class, perhaps you could help us with a little more contour to that. Does that mean that there are people whose class interests as billionaires and nowadays trillionaires for the first time are such that differences of race and religion and language and geography fall away and they work together for the parthenogenesis of their class?
Right. Well, in their ranks, yes, in their ranks. So let's look at this. So we traditionally study, those of us that research capitalism and the capitalist class, traditionally study the formation and development of a capitalist class in each nation state. We're talking about an English capitalist class, a U.S. capitalist class, a German capitalist class, a Brazilian capitalist class. That's how this research and that's how this discussion has been going for several centuries now. But what we saw in the second half of the 20th century and accelerating in the early 21st century is that the leading fractions among these different national capitalist classes, not only have they gone global in the sense that the whole global market, the whole global economy is their field of action. That's what they look at. They don't look at their own countries, but they look at the world as a whole, the globe as a whole. But as these different fractions, transnationalized fractions of these capitalist groups have gone global, they've interpenetrated with one another across borders. They've cross invested with one another. They've had mergers and acquisitions with one another. And so you get the rise of, and I'm not talking about maybe not even numerically the majority of capitalists in the world, but the leading fraction is one that's dominant worldwide. The one we can say is the hegemonic fraction, to use technical language, worldwide, is this transnational capitalist class. Now, you asked a really good question. You say, do they leave behind gender, racial, ethnic, and other types of cleavages that rack our societies? And I said that for the most part, yes, in the sense that certainly this transnational capitalist class is predominantly male rather than female. And certainly the majority of its members still come from the traditional Western core of world capitalism, from Western Europe, from Japan, of course, from the United States. But that's been changing and very rapidly. So now that you get members of this transnational capitalist class from different Latin American countries, especially Brazil, Mexico, Argentina, Chile, you get, of course, from China. There's more Chinese billionaires now than transnational, you know, than there are in the United States. And even from some of the leading African countries, not just South Africa, from Egypt, from Saudi Arabia, from India, of course, from Nigeria. And so when they enter the ranks of this transnational capitalist class, the cream of this global corporate elite, they don't consider distinctions of race, ethnicity, gender, or nationality. Now, that doesn't mean that we back home in our nation states and our global society don't have those cleavages and those conflicts. They're raging just as they always have been.
Right. So thinking of Carlos Slim bailing out the New York Times in 2008 would be an example of that. But also the fact that these folks are sending their children to the Ivy Leagues. They're exactly. sending their children mm-hmm. to Oxbridge. They're sending their children to the UC. They want to reproduce privilege in a way that is cosmopolitan, that suits exactly. many of the liberal mm-hmm. values of some forms of capitalism, right?
Absolutely. The cosmopolitanism is one of the flags of this transnational capitalist class, their world outlook, their cultural outlook. And it's good that you mentioned these elite universities and, of course, preparatory schools as well before you even get to the universities. Because I published an article, I believe it came out in 2016 or 2017, because I wanted to look at that. So in sociology, we study so of course, socialization processes, but more specifically, when we're studying elites and capitalist classes, we say that they cannot be a cohesive capitalist class or a cohesive elite just simply on the basis of their economic interests alone. They also need cultural cohesion, social cohesion. They need to share a world outlook and develop a consciousness of themselves as some type of a unified group. And so that's done at many different levels in the cultural sphere, of course, but specifically in the educational sphere, going to these elite preparatory schools and centers of higher education where they meet one another, mix and develop their collective world outlook and their, you know, collective transnational class culture. So yes, that's critically important part of the story of the formation of this new global ruling class.
Now, one of the main areas that you've studied in your many powerful, valued and valuable books and articles is Latin America. I wonder if you could talk to us about the situation in the past. For 25 years, you've been writing about Latin America, and the present. What's going on? What's changing? Because to throw in my oar, as it were, what we're seeing with putatively progressive administrations like in Chile, Colombia and Brazil is a haunting from what happened to Allende in 73, and a recognition that the United States will do whatever it damn well pleases if financial markets in particular are perturbed in some way, and there will be coups against democratically elected progressives. So that's my version of what these folks are doing. Tell me where I'm wrong or where I'm right and what your story is.
Well, you're right, but there's a bigger story there. So let's look at that. The first thing I say is that the original testing ground for neoliberalism was Chile with the coup in 1973. From there, it spread all around the world. We entered the neoliberal era, which for me is the era of capitalist globalization. And so neoliberalism becomes most developed in the 1980s and 1990s into the 21st century in Latin America. And then, in fact, neoliberalism world is now in crisis worldwide, but it enters into its crisis first in Latin America. And that's expressed politically in terms of the turn to the left. In the early 21st century, of course, you had the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela. You had the rise of Evo Morales and the indigenous radical governments in Bolivia. You had the turn to the left. And, you know, throughout the whole region, everyone, you know, we're all familiar with that. It's called the pink tide, because it wasn't a turn towards communism, right? A red side, but it wasn't. It was definitely a turn to the left. So we have that expression, the pink tide. So then what you have is a situation where the original pink tide, they tried to bring about significant structural transformations in the political economy and the society in which over which these movements were governing. And they found that to be extremely difficult, and extremely difficult for several reasons. But the one I want to highlight here is that in this age of capitalist globalization, every country in the world has now integrated into this new globally integrated production, financial and service economy. And that dependence has been heightened many times over. No country can withdraw now from global capitalism. If we want to transform global capitalism, it has to come from within. But that's another question, another discussion. But what I'm getting at here is that it's simply impossible, in my view, and the experience of Latin America bears this out, to undertake very significant structural transformations. I'm talking about transformations in property relations and class relations. I'm not talking about social democratic redistribution. That was the achievement that those governments have had, that redistributed wealth downward by taxing corporations and exports and so forth. But here's the crucial point I want to make. You're pointing correctly to the history of U.S. intervention. The United States overthrows any government that challenges the interests, its interests, or more specifically now, the interests of global capitalism. But here's the thing, that to the extent that we have a globally integrated financial system, the extent to which every country is now so dependent on the flow of transnational finance capital into their territories, of transnational investors into their territories, there's this new thing we can call, and I call, the structural power of transnational capital over the direct power of states. So if that sounds loaded, what I'm getting at here is that very often the United States doesn't need to send in the Marines or even carry out a coup d'etat. You simply have this incredible transnational financial structural pressure over governments to keep them in line, to keep them from withdrawing from the circuits of, you know, a global capitalist accumulation. It doesn't always work. We know that there's been sanctions and destabilization efforts against the Venezuelan governments, of course, continued against the Cuban government. So that's thrown in there. But I would suggest that the biggest mechanism to keep Latin America in line has been this structural power of transnational finance capital.
And Prof, one of the interesting things for us to ponder in all of this is another take of mine. And again, I leave it up to you as a world expert to comment on this, that we have a model of entirely decadent and ultimately inefficient, albeit massively powerful and awful, imperialism and colonialism, per the Spanish and the Portuguese initially, and then the English, the Dutch, the Belgians, the Germans, the French, and so on, refined into a much more efficient model, the US one, where there are occasional interventions, occasional acts of colonialism, some of which are somewhat ongoing, but by and large, you don't waste money on that crap, right? Mm-hmm. You're there to protect US interests. It seems to me China's learned from that model and in a way is refining it still further. Not that interested in possession of Africa, possession of Latin America. Very interested in possession of parts of Asia. Interested in how it can appear to engage in commercially driven development projects rather than old style development projects, but probably with interests also in protecting global supply lines in the event of the United States.
Sure. Well, let me make two comments. I mean, this is crucially important, but one of the reasons, well, the big reason I would say that the United States did not need to acquire direct colonies for its version of imperialism in the way that the UK and before that the Spanish and the Dutch, as you pointed out, did in earlier centuries from 1492 right up until the early 20th century, is that the 400 and some odd year process of colonialism and imperialism already integrated the entire world into the global market. And that integration has deepened in the late 20th, early 21st century. So, and this goes back to what we were discussing with Latin America. Once you're integrated, once these countries are now open to transnational capitalist plunder, and, you know, an exploitation, you don't need to have direct colonies. There's no reason right now to recolonize the Congo for China, and for that matter, for investors from anywhere, including South Africa, including Rwanda, to get to the cobalt and the coltan, which is necessary for the new digital revolution. You don't need to go back and again colonize the Central American countries when their elites and their masses are dependent on their integration into world capitalism. Of course, you still need some military interventions that the United States is certainly pleased to carry out when it can get away with it. If there's some upstarts, if there's any threat to that integration. But we can say that the dirty work was already done by the Spanish, the Dutch, the British in earlier centuries. But let's turn specifically to China, because this is really important. Of course, it's cutting edge. We're seeing right now the intensification of geopolitical competition and conflict, very dangerous because it can lead to another world war. But at the beginning of your question, you said that the U.S., you know, does this intervention or the U.S. version of imperialism to defend U.S. interests. While I'm not disagreeing with that, I think we have to specify a bit more. And we have to say the real interests that have been defended by U.S. intervention in U.S. foreign policy, U.S. imperialism in the last few decades of capitalist globalization has been the interests of global capitalism as a whole. So let me explain why this is so important. I published an article last summer, about 8 months ago. I got a lot of criticism for it. The title of it was The Unbearable Manichaeism of the Anti-Imperialist Left. And anti-imperialist there, of course, in quotation marks. And I was pointing out that in the West, in Western Europe and in the United States, we condemn U.S. intervention imperialism, and that we should. But sometimes we do so and at the same time as we turn a blind eye to exploitation by Chinese-based transnational corporations backed by the Chinese government or Russian-based, Russian imperialism, if we want to call it that. In the name of opposing the principle imperialism, which is in the West. Why am I saying all of this? Because in that article, I pointed something out. I pointed out that the biggest or the second biggest open pit copper mine in the world is Las Bambas, which is located in the Peruvian highlands in indigenous communities. And for the past several years, those indigenous communities have had running pitched battles with the Chinese corporation, which runs that mine, because they've been kicked off their land, their rivers and land is being poisoned by the chemicals that are involved. Every time they protest, the workers, they were peasants, now they lose their land, they become workers in the mine, they fight for higher wages. In comes the Peruvian police to repress them. It's a big bloody mess. Now, this is a country which is, we historically think, is in the U.S. fold. It's not, you know, it's protected by U.S. imperialism, U.S. intervention. And sure enough, that is the case. But here you have Chinese investors extracting this copper very violently from Peru, exploiting Peruvian indigenous workers, and they don't need to. The Chinese colonized Peru, but moreover than that, here's the ironic thing: there was a coup d'état in Peru in 2022. Some of the listeners will remember that Pedro Castillo was a left-oriented president, and you know, he'd asked about Latin America, and sure, there's still some of those coup d'états. So he was removed from office, and right after him being removed from office, the United States increased its training and its financing of the Peruvian police. And this is the same Peruvian police that then go to that open pit copper mine, Las Bambas, and repress the indigenous peasants and workers fighting the Chinese-based copper mine. So here you really get a picture with what I'm describing here of this new globalized capitalism and how it really requires us to rethink how we've been thinking about and analyzing the world in the last few decades, because things have changed and they continue to change very rapidly.
Point taken, and I think that's an interesting one, the Peruvian case. We've just had recently the 200th anniversary, if one could call it that, of the Monroe Doctrine, which of course was initially enunciated to stop the British and the French from trying to run Latin America, even though it was done mm-hmm. in the recognizing independence and sovereignty and so on, but essentially it's been that those origins are forgotten. It's a license to kill for the United
Right.
States. I mean, no one can deny that. And it doesn't matter if your last name is Obama or Bush, you subscribe to it.
Right.
It's very simple,
Absolutely.
very straightforward. And whenever people tell me the US, sphere of influence is eroding, it's all ending, it doesn't matter anymore, I can't help but think of my time spent in Latin America and my comrades there and what they experience on an almost daily basis in terms of the institutionalized violence that the United States subtends. No? And whilst that is the most, I think, dramatic instance we have in the contemporary world, it's everywhere. It's in the attitude of Taiwanese and Vietnamese and Japanese and Korean people wanting US presence against China. It's in the actions of Israel. I don't need to tell you this, it's obvious. But I
Right.
guess my concern is one can overemphasize Chinese hegemony and forget the centrality of the United States. Wherever I go in the world, that's the
Right.
country people want to talk to me about, they want to know about, they want to understand. And it's partly an economic and a military thing, and it's also a cultural thing, isn't it?
Culture is certainly a part of the story, but let me say that, of course, you're absolutely right. I have in my some recent articles on this exact issue of how we understand imperialism in the 21st century, how we understand US-Chinese competition, the increase of the increase in geopolitical conflict. And I repeatedly pointed out in those articles and in those interviews that from the viewpoint of the vast majority of the world's people, the greatest danger to peace, the greatest danger to the world's people remains the United States. The US state has its tentacles everywhere. It's just as dangerous US intervention around the world, US policy around the world as it's ever been. I mean, there's genocide as we speak being, unfolding in Gaza, in Palestine, and that could not possibly take place if it wasn't for US sponsorship of that genocide. It's irrelevant what Biden says that he doesn't want Rafah to be, attacked, or he wants less civilian deaths. You're handing all of these weapons and then saying, well, just be careful with them, try not to kill so many people. So of course the United States is the greatest danger to world peace and the security of the vast majority of the people in the world, and that has not decreased. And I don't think we can really talk about Chinese hegemony as much as we can talk about China as a rising power, right? And there's more to discuss there. I don't want to go into too much detail unless you ask me with a follow-up question, if that's where you want to take the interview. But I think one thing going on is that you have in China two sets of elites. Now, obviously, they're cross-penetrated, but you have private transnational capitalists. They're based in China and they operate all around the world. Some two-thirds, some 67, 68% of the Chinese economy is private capital. Chinese ch private Chinese capital and private transnational capital co-invested there. And then you have the party state elite. Now, I reiterate, they overlap to an extent, but we don't want to overemphasize how they overlap, because there's sort of a complex situation in my analysis in which the Chinese state elite, the party elite, those that actually control, the development of, supervise the development of capitalism in China and Chinese foreign policy and policy towards the rest of the world, they're seeking the aggrandizement of China, right? In the, in the classical sense that China should be a big power in the world, whereas the Chinese-based transnational capitalists, what they're seeking really is just to be able to operate around the world, accumulate capital, plunder, et cetera, expand. And for that, US intervention does the trick. That's why I want to come back to this point. I mentioned Peru, but let's look at the Congo. The vast majority of the cobalt pouring out of the Congo is controlled by Chinese-based investors. I think the last figure was 90%. And those Chinese investors, they don't need to have Chinese hegemony. They don't. They just need to make sure that they can get into that cobalt. And by the way, the cobalt then goes from the Congo to these factories in China, where Apple and Western-based and corporations from all over the world use that cobalt for their electronic, you know, the production of electronic and digital goods. So again, yes, we can talk about U.S. imperialism and intervention. We can talk about Chinese hegemony or wannabe hegemony. But there's still, I want to come back to this, insist, a larger story of how world capitalism, global society, has been transforming in recent decades. And it requires that we do some rethinking. And if you're familiar with my research, you know that that's what it's been all about for the last 30 years, how we go about that rethinking. And I would say one other thing here, that there's an increase in the rapidity of change worldwide, meaning things are changing so rapidly right now that it's hard to keep up with all of this change, but it's also hard to keep up analytically and theoretically with what's going on. But that's what's required of us as, you know, as thinking members of global society, not just as academics and, you know, and journalists.
Well, the picture that you and I have jointly and individually painted in the last little while can be seen as quite pessimistic. But one of your recent books is Can Global Capitalism Endure? And it's very much got a question mark in the title. And this is a book that lays out for us very clearly, amongst other things, the environmental crisis engendered by capital. And it also has hope for a global socialism.
Right.
Could you talk to us a bit about the book and that hope, that element of positiveness?
Sure. Absolutely. So we started the interview with me commenting that my chief concern at this point is trying to understand this unprecedented crisis of global capitalism. And that's what that little book, Can Global Capitalism Endure, is all about. For me, there are four big dimensions that I mentioned there in that book. One, of course, is the structural, the economic or the structural crisis, which we call overaccumulation. Now, the effects of overaccumulation on profit rates and on being wealthy has not yet hit the person that you spoke with in Santa Barbara, California. But nonetheless, structurally, that is there, meaning that there's enormous amount of wealth, of capital has been accumulated, profits have been accumulated, and there are shrinking opportunities to continue investing and accumulating that capital. So there's this crisis of overaccumulation, a crisis of where do you unload all of this surplus capital to continue to accumulate? That's structural. But then there's the political dimension of the global crisis. We've been talking about some of it. There's crisis of state legitimacy all over the world, which is not necessarily a bad thing for social movements trying to change the system. I'll get back to that in a minute. But you have this political crisis of state legitimacy. States are not considered legitimate by masses of people because they don't meet their needs. And that's, of course, why you have this emerging social base for fascist organizers. But that political crisis is not just state legitimacy. It's one of capitalist hegemony. A significant portion of people around the world don't see capitalism as a legitimate system that meets their needs. And of course, part of the political crisis we were already discussing, which is of geopolitical conflict, which hopefully will not escalate into world war. But then there's a third dimension, the social dimension, in the sense that whole communities, whole regions of the world, look at Haiti right now, look at the Eastern Congo, look at Sudan, are collapsing. Social disintegration has never been so vast and so threatening for hundreds of millions, maybe billions of people. And it's a serious question. And then surplus humanity is expanding, that portion of humanity which is capital does not need to exploit. It's just locked out. So there's the whole question of how global capitalism can achieve the social reproduction of a significant portion of humanity. Then the fourth dimension, which you mentioned and which really for me makes it existential, is the ecological dimension, right? It's the threat of the collapse of the biosphere. And that is why I say that this crisis is different. It's not just the magnitude of the crisis, right? Which is also unprecedented. But it's also because in the past, people on the left or simply any observers often thought when there was a major crisis, like in the 1970s, especially the 1930s, for instance, Marx thought so in the 1840s, early 1830s, 1840s, that each crisis was going to be the terminal crisis of capitalism, right? that's it. The system cannot recover. And that proved that it's been proved that capitalism is much more resilient. It always does not exhaust its potential. It has a new round of expansion, reorganization, and it is born anew, like a phoenix. But so why am I arguing in that book that this may be the terminal crisis? It's especially because of that ecological dimension. My specialty is not the environmental sociology. I'm not an ecologist, but I've done enough studying to see that the writing is on the wall there, that there are ecological limits to the reproduction of global capitalism. So here's the thing and why I have a question mark there. Number one, I'm not going to say definitively this is the terminal crisis. That would be foolish of any analyst, any scholar. But what I'm suggesting is that we're not at the verge of a revolution. We're still going to have capitalism for the next few years. I'd like to have it end tomorrow, but that's not going to happen. Even the next few decades. But I don't see, without a radical change, which means moving beyond capitalism, how this system can continue to reproduce itself into the 22nd century. So that's what that little book is all about, trying to speculate, the nature of this crisis and how it's so severe that capitalism is reaching the end of the ability to renew itself. And again, I just conclude by saying I'm not talking about the short term. I think the digital technologies that are just now coming online, along with other changes, mean that we're probably going to see a new round of capitalist expansion, recovery and expansion after another collapse. I'm predicting there'll be another collapse maybe a year from now, maybe 2 years from now, maybe 2 months from now. No, very few saw the 2008 collapse suddenly coming. But that won't be the end of world capitalism. I think there will be a recovery and there'll be a new round of expansion. And then after that, it's anyone's, speculation as to after that, how could there be the reproduction of global capitalism. But anyway, I've thrown a lot out there. This is a deeply analytical and theoretical debate as well as an empirical one.
And of course, part of this is also the repressive state apparatus. And one of your other fairly recent books is The Global Police State and the way in which capitalistic invocations of freedom are constantly contradicted by its desire to lock every bastard up. It's clear that in the United States, what is needed is the second emancipation.
Mm-hmm.
Because we still have slavery. It's called the federal and state prison system.
Right.
But of course, some of it is organized in the interests of capital. But could you elucidate for us a little bit about what's meant by the global police state and how it functions?
Sure. There's three dimensions. And it's good that you mentioned mass incarceration in the United States, because that model of mass incarceration is now being exported around the world. We're seeing that increasingly it's not a specific U.S. phenomenon, but a worldwide phenomenon. But so I mean three things by the global police state. The first, of course, you've already alluded to, the increasingly repressive character of the whole global capitalist system. We're seeing a breakdown of consensual mechanisms of domination. And a move towards more and more coercive mechanisms of direct social control, repression, and domination. Very much we can evoke Gramsci here, that the ruling groups under capitalism ruled by both it's a center, right? Center, that's the beast. I forgot the name of the beast if I'm pronouncing it right. But half beast, half man is the face of capitalism. So you always have that repressive side and you always have the consensual side. But we're seeing a shift now from the consensual to the openly repressive side. And it can't be any other way given the current nature of global society. You have 1% of humanity controlling 52-53% of the world's wealth. And that's going up and up and up. The Oxfam's most recent report in January reported that even over the last year, wealth is concentrated even more and more in that 1%. And then you have the other next 20%, which is the world's affluence, not necessarily even affluence, but you can at least survive get by. That 20% controls 95% of the world's wealth. So you have a situation where 80% of humanity has just 5% of the world's wealth. I've mentioned already this crisis of survival, of social reproduction. And so the ruling groups need a repressive instrument. They've always had armies and police, but they need a much more sophisticated, widespread, integrated, repressive instrument all around the world to maintain control over surplus humanity, which we can estimate at about 2 billion people, and the global working and popular classes, especially at a time when a global revolt is underway, where people are questioning the legitimacy of the system, where social and political movements are burgeoning everywhere. So the threat is very real. And so you see at this as this instrument of you know, total repression around the world. It's not just, you pointed out correctly, mass incarceration. There's also a war against immigrants. Wherever you, there's immigrant detention centers. There's borders between poor and rich places, and the, you know, the global economy and society are zones of death and destruction. Where you have this massive war to control people that are on the move. You have an estimate of up to 1 billion people throughout this century, by 2050, are going to be displaced by climate change. They need to be carefully controlled. We're moving towards a fortress world. But it's not just also that. It's, as I pointed out in that book, the global police state, a majority of, there's more private guards in the world than there are police officers. And now there's private armies. There's not just the Wagner Group from Russia. There's not just the, used to be called Blackwater, but I forgot they changed their name in the United States. But all over the world, there's private armies, private police forces. And, you know, we can go on and on. All of these dimensions of this globally integrated repressive apparatus. And the transnational capitalist class depends on that. But so that's one. But the second dimension of global police state is that it's incredibly profitable. It's unbelievably profitable to invest in a military-industrial security complex, which in turn is integrated with Silicon Valley and with big tech. I lay that out in that book that you mentioned and my subsequent book titled Global Civil War. And then third, it's all integrated with the global financial conglomerates, with BlackRock and with all of them. So you get this block of capital, the military industrial security complex, big tech and big finance. It all has come together since 2001 around the increasing militarization of global society and converting war and conflict and systems of repression and social control into profit making activities in and of themselves, independent of political considerations. I know I'm talking a lot, but let me just remind, let listeners know about the one example I gave in that book. And it is that we have all of this repressive anti-immigrant legislation in the United States. But in fact, that legislation was drafted by these companies that run the private immigrant detention centers. And they drafted this legislation not because they're racists who don't like Latin American immigrants. They could care less about that. They drafted it because you open up a private immigrant detention center, and then you need a war on immigrants in order to have immigrants come and be locked up in your detention center because you're making profit. And so you have to shift the whole cultural and ideological environment to be anti-immigrant, to scapegoat immigrants, to be racist. But you're doing so in order to make profit. So that's the second dimension of global police state, is this enormous profit-making opportunity at a time of stagnation in other sectors. And finally, to conclude, the third dimension I'm getting at here is this shift towards political systems of that are authoritarian, dictatorial, and even fascist. We're moving away from democratic or polyarchic political systems as part of this global police state.
The book you just mentioned, Global Civil War, is your contribution to thinking about life during and after, if there is an after, COVID-19. I wrote a book about it based on life in Mexico, Colombia, the US, and Britain during the first two waves.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, as I had thought in 2008, that these things would presage a cathartic moment in which there would be a fundamental rejection of neoliberalism. I think at some level that's right, in the sense that after 2008, there's a return to Keynesianism public policy in lots of ways. But my notion that there would be a recognition of everybody's dependence on the benevolent aspects of the state that would flow from COVID-19 has been wrong. And in fact, your book's right.
Yeah, I wish yours was right and not mine. But let's look at that. Let's break that down. You know, why is that so? So you have a situation where certainly since 2008, this global revolt has been underway, and it has not let up. And then it reaches this first crescendo in fall of 2019. Now, let's remember that the end of that 2019 December, there was a, and I'm using this one example to show the extent of that global revolt. There was a general strike of 150 million people in India in late 2019, early 2020. Fast forward 1 year later, a second one involving 250 million people. These are levels of popular mobilization and struggle simply unprecedented. That was the single biggest labor mobilization in the history of the world. It's more people took part in that than most countries have as their total population. So what I'm getting at is this global revolt from below in rejection, not just of neoliberalism, but calling for more radical, you know, restructuring and social justice in their countries is unprecedented. So why has it not led, as you point out, to the end of neoliberalism and some type of another project? Well, I'd say there's two big reasons, or let's say three reasons. But the first is that these movements are acephalous in the sense that there's not in most countries, there's not an organized left that has renewed itself for the 21st century. The 20th century left can't do the trick. And that has put forward a viable alternative project, an emancipatory project that all of these different social movements and popular groups can rally around and organize around. And so you've had this big gap between masses of people engaged in uprisings and a left project that can direct that into a transformation. That's one big factor. The other one, and you pointed this out right, that after 2008, there's a lot of neo-Keynesianism. There's state intervention to prop up capital in a way which violates the tenets of neoliberalism, et cetera, et cetera. And so you do get this reformist elite that wants to look for some type of a global neo-Keynesianism, to a reintroduction of regulation of global markets, of national but also global markets, redistributive measures such as universal basic income, et cetera, et cetera. But this reformist elite, and they're clustered very significantly in the World Economic Forum, but also in different groups within political parties, social democratic and liberal political parties around the world, but they don't have the upper hand. They don't have the upper hand, and part of the reason they don't have the upper hand, I think, is going back to the structural power of transnational finance capital, to block reforms that, in the interest of saving capitalism from itself, would place some brakes on the complete freedom, put some brake onto the some restrictions on the complete freedom of transnational capital. So that's the moment that we're at. But neoliberalism is in crisis. That's the crisis of global capitalism. There's also a crisis of the neoliberal model of global capitalism.
And I guess let's take this back well before your Global Civil War book, well before your Global Police State book. You wrote a book for Hopkins 20 years ago that is The Theory of Global Capitalism. Are there things that have changed since then that have shifted your analysis at all?
Yes, and thank you for asking that question. So, of course, the world is constantly changing, and any theory is only worth how it can explain a given reality in the real world. So, I would absolutely, that's when I fully laid out what I refer to as my theory of global capitalism. And I fully defend the theory itself and its ability to explain the changes that took place from the 1970s into 2004, when that book came out, and moreover, its ability to explain the changes from 2004 to 2024. But the explanation, so the theory is good, solid, but how we wield it to explain a change in reality requires a lot of footwork, so to say, a lot of mental work, right? A lot of analysis and theorization. So the weakness in that book, it was that I had not fully understood, and I broke it down in that book, and I broke it down in subsequent work. But this relationship between state and capital, right, and the shifting nature of the relationship between state and capital. So right now, I've been, especially with the rise of China, and we spoke about that a little bit earlier, but this rising rivalry among big states, rising geopolitical competition and conflict, that is crying out for an explanation. And I think global capitalism theory can explain it. That's what I've attempted to do more recently. In fact, things that are in the publication pipeline, they're not even out. So just in a nutshell, what I didn't say in that book and what I'm emphasizing now is that states, referring to the nation state, the national state, the state inside a particular each nation state, they have a contradictory mandate. On the one hand, their mandate is to facilitate transnational capital accumulation inside their territory, in order to bring jobs, in order to boost GDP, GNP. That's exactly what Trump did, exactly what Biden did, exactly what is doing, exactly what Obama did. I mean, all the U.S. state has to encourage accumulation inside the United States. That's the nature of capitalism. Right. And but the type of accumulation they have to encourage is transnational, because that's capital, is transnational. So that's one function of the state, of the nations, the national state. The other function is to achieve legitimacy, to hold together the social order, to reproduce that internal social order, to assure that the whole thing doesn't fall apart. And that is something which requires that each state, especially the more powerful ones, are in competition and rivalry with other states. And that's a big part of the story of rising geopolitical conflict, which obviously is too much to go into here in the interview. But that 2004 book was a time when neoliberalism enjoyed, you know, total hegemony, and a time when transnational capital very aggressively was integrating every corner of the world into this system. And it was not yet a time where these contradictions, you know, the contradiction I've just indicated, was fully revealing itself, fully playing out. And now that is happening. So I wouldn't say, definitely, just to reiterate by way of conclusion, I would absolutely defend what I argued in the 2004 book, but it requires an updating to what's the reality in 2024 moving forward.
And thinking back on the last quarter of a century, Prof, there have been two books, I would say, that have cut through the divide between academic and popular knowledge, at least within global elites. One would be Empire by Hart and Negri. Mm-hmm. Other, mm-hmm. the various inequality books by Piketty.
Mm-hmm.
And you've engaged some of Piketty's work very specifically. One could make arguments against those books, against the immaterialist take provided by Hart and Negri, for example. But they seem to me to be symptomatic of something else, that one can now cite Marx without being told one is opposed to the freedom of speech. The Financial Times, The New Yorker, The Economist don't like unions, they don't like Marxists, but they quite like Marx, and they're quite interested in Engels.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Something's happening here, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah, that's fantastic that you're pointing to that. And that goes back to something I mentioned but very briefly in the earlier part of our discussion. And it's that a significant portion of transnational elites, and when I use the term transnational elites, I'm not just referring to capitalists, but also to intellectuals, to, you know, to political figures, to the people that edit the Economist, right? And so a significant portion of those elites, which is still, although still a minority, recognizes that world capitalism is in deep trouble. It's in crisis. They share my analysis. They use different language, different ways of explaining it, and different solutions, of course. But they recognize that capitalism needs to be saved from itself, and it needs to be saved from itself by changing the way that it's currently functioning, by reorganizing capitalism. That's what's always saved capitalism. In the 1930s, it was New Deal capitalism, social democratic capitalism, that and the Keynesian state that saved capitalism at that time. In the 1970s, it was reorganized in the reverse direction, is to neoliberalism and capitalist globalization, but that saved capitalism. So now these elites, and that's why Piketty is, you know, so popular among these elites, because Piketty is calling for very significant redistribution. He's not really calling for an overthrow of capitalism, right? Empire is another question, that book. But so here's the thing. In order to understand this crisis, you need historical materialism. You need Marx. And so it's not surprising that, you know, the editors of the Financial Times, the editors of The Economist, and others are turning towards Marx as a method of analyzing this crisis because they want to resolve it in favor of a new lease on life for global capitalism. Whereas we turn to Marx in order to understand this crisis in capitalism so as to overthrow it.
Point taken. But it is fascinating to me that these books sold so many copies, got so much attention from the bourgeois press, when nothing on the left had done that since, I don't know, Michael Harrington in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
These are extraordinary achievements for whatever reason. And they give me some hope, even as I see what you're saying, Prof. They're part of the toolbox of renewal for these people. I do take that point. So I've got a couple more questions, and then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you wish to what we've discussed. Does that sound okay? Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So my first question is, how do you find things out? This is like the Committee on Academic Personnel on the University of California, and I'm a biologist or a neoclassical economist. So, Professor Robinson, how do you know all this?
Right. Well, you know, of course, the whole interview could just be around that in many different levels. But, well, to begin with, let me just explain something personally. I was a journalist for 10 years before I moved into academia. And, you know, journalists have the advantage that you're moving in, out in the real world. You're not in the ivory tower. You're not just speaking to other academics. And you're really concerned about real world events. You can talk to people. So, you know, researching, at least not so much the quantitative research in terms of number crunching, but researching in terms of getting information in the real world and processing it, you know, throw in theory to help me process it, comes quite naturally to me. I'm assuming you're not asking a question of, you know, what's my methodology. But I think that I would not be able to do what I'm at least trying to do now if I had not had that experience as a journalist. And I also left the United States when I was 18 years old. I didn't come back until my 30s. You know, I participated in the Sandinista Revolution. I spent 3 years in East and West Africa. And so, you know, that allowed me to get, combined with being a journalist, allowed me to get a very different real world perspective, which is fundamental to me trying to understand and write about, the world. I, you know, it's kind of an awkward question to answer. The question's good, but I haven't given such systematic thought to how I try and find out what I find out. I think there's also an element, and this is true for journalists, this is true for many people, and it should be true for all academics. There's an element of intuition. Now, what I mean by that, right, is not that we just trust our intuition, but our intuition gives us a hint, and then we know where we might want to look, where we might want to follow up, where we might want to explore something. If we don't discover there, you know, what we're looking for, then we say, okay, never mind that intuition. But there's an element of intuition that you get in other professions, such as journalism, that you don't necessarily get in academia, and academics should have. There's one other thing, and this actually directly answers, you know, responds to your question. And most academics are too damn concerned about their career, their reputation in the mainstream, even leftist academics. And so I'm on the record here saying that, you know, a lot of us academics need to come off our high horse and stop thinking in careerist terms, because not just because politically that's no good, but also because it blocks us from having the boldness, right, to interrogate the world in a literally a radical way, meaning radical, the Latin term is to get to the roots of. So I don't know if I've really answered your question, but those are the thoughts that came to my mind.
No, that's great. Thank you. Because I think that this element of raíces is really valuable. I think that talking about, empirical knowledge, but also inference, which I think is the movement between intuition
Right.
and empirical.
Yes. Yes.
And experience in the global south is utterly crucial. I am yet to find in the contemporary world an academic whose work interests me who has not spent time in the global south
Right.
or is from the global south. A big essentialist statement, but there it is. So, Prof, that was my second last question. My last question before throwing to you and inviting you to add anything you want is, now that I've asked you the Committee on Academic Personnel, Professor Robinson, why should you get an increment query? Is we've gone forward 20 years from your pathbreaking Hopkins book. What can you see for us 2 decades from now?
Wow. So there's what state will the world be in, and then what state will my own research and writing be in, right? And sort of they're of course linked with each other, but what state the world will be in, here's where we really need to try and remain optimistic, right? And in part, we can remain optimistic by seeing these contradictions in this global capitalist system, and how they open up space and opportunities for those of us combating it. So, I mean, I think I pretty much already mentioned that sometime way before this 20 years from now, we're going to have another collapse. I mean, I really think that's close to inevitable, for reasons we obviously can't get into now. And then there's going to be recovery from that collapse. Maybe not. Maybe there'll be a long, you know, prolonged collapse. Maybe it will lead to a world war and we'll be annihilated in a nuclear exchange. Maybe there will be revolutions, and I'm underestimating the prospects for actual anti-capitalist revolutions. But I think I would put myself on a limb by saying there'll be another collapse. There'll be a recovery of capitalism from it, world capitalism, and but the situation of the mass of the world's people, such as the people suffering right now in the Congo, over 6 million people have just recently been displaced. Not even talking about the 5 million that were killed, you know, that died in the late 20th, early 21st century. There's millions now displaced in Sudan. There's Haiti is literally collapsing. So I think all of those horrors being inflicted disproportionately in the global south, but we also need to look at the third worldization of the former third world, the downward mobility of masses of what were stable sectors of the global working class and the global north. So I think all of this misery and, you know, all of this unbelievable suffering is going to intensify over the next 20 years. I'm not wanting it. None of us want it, right? But I'm predicting that before there's some radical change, it's going to still get worse. So that's on the one hand, but I hope I am wrong. I really hope so. I don't want to end this interview on a pessimistic note. And again, the optimism here is twofold. I've been criticized by my Marxist comrades and colleagues on this point. And it's not that I'm arguing that we struggle for reform and not for revolution. I would like revolution. But I think that realistically, we have more of a chance in the next few years of getting significant reform that improves the situation for the vast majority of humanity through redistribution of wealth downward forced on the system, through regulation of transnational capital, forced on transnational capital. And how does that reform come about? Not that we limit ourselves to that, but how did the New Deal come about? It came about because socialist and communist and radical forces and trade unions from below were fighting for something much more radical, for socialism. And in so-called enlightened elites from above were fighting to save capitalism from itself. They met halfway between. Right. And that's what reformed capitalism in a way which for a significant portion of the world's population was for the better. Didn't resolve the contradictions, of course. So my hope here is that while we've struggled to overthrow capitalism, it forces the system to carry out reforms that help the masses of the world's people while we still struggle for a brand new system. And getting carried away with too much detail and, you know, too much speculation here. But I conclude by saying, where do I see my own research in the next 20 years? And I don't think it will change. I've always tried to, my main focus has been to analyze changes in the whole macro big picture. I've always done big picture analyses and theorization. That won't change, and I think that's my big contribution to our, both to our understanding of the world, but also as analytical and theoretical instruments that mass struggles can use. I hope that's helpful.
That's great. And finally, are there things that you'd like to add to what we've discussed?
Gosh, no, because if I say anything, it's going to be very long-winded because there'd be a million things I'd want to add.
That's a perfect answer. Thank you, Bill. It was great.
Thank you so much. Great discussion.